Bonjour et bienvenue à McGill, cette belle matinée du mois de mai. Je m'appelle Laurent Midlarski et je suis le vice-doyen des programmes universitaires de la faculté de génie à McGill. Good morning. My name is Laurent Midlarski, and in my capacity as Associate Dean Academic Programs in the Faculty of Engineering, and on behalf of Dean Jim Nicel, I would like to welcome you. So who are the professors that students remember long after graduation? What makes great teachers great? The short answer to these questions is, it's not what professors do, it's what they understand. Lesson plans and lecture notes matter less than the special way teachers comprehend the subject and value human learning. Whether historians, engineers, or physicists, the best teachers know their subject inside out, but they also know how to engage and challenge students and to provoke impassioned responses. Most of all, they fervently believe two things, that teaching matters and that students can learn. These are some of the findings from Professor Bain's scholarly work in the field of teaching and learning for higher education for more than 30 years. Historian and educator, and president of the Best Teachers Institute, Professor Bain spent much of his academic career at Vanderbilt, Northwestern, and NYU before becoming provost and vice president for academic affairs at the University of the District of Columbia, a post he left in July of 2013. He was the founding director of four major teaching and learning centers, the Center for Teaching Excellence at NYU, the Searle Center for Teaching Excellence at Northwestern, the Center for Teaching at Vanderbilt University, and the Research Academy for University Learning at Montclair University. In the 70s and 80s, Professor Bain was professor of history at the University of Texas, Pan American. During today's session, Professor Bain will present recent research that finds that students don't always learn as deeply as we once thought they did. He will also introduce some new findings in teaching and learning that can help us foster deep learning amongst our students and the development of adaptive expertise. Our world is changing rapidly, and we need to produce more graduates that can adapt to these changes. This session will help us think differently about teaching and learning and stimulating both student motivation and achievement. Our keynote speaker today has inspired people around the world to change their approach to teaching and learning in a broad range of disciplines, and we are honored to have him with us this morning. However, before we begin, I would like to acknowledge how today's annual conference has come about. In 2013, one of our faculty's alumni provided generous funding to help improve the undergraduate classroom experience. He felt that excellent researchers don't always naturally make top teachers, and he really wanted to help students learn and remain engaged. Although our initial discussion centered on teaching awards to recognize outstanding professors, as the conversation evolved, it became clear that it would be more effective to explore how teaching and learning, how learning happens. So 3 years ago, with support from McGill's Teaching and Learning Services, a small group of professors came together and our initiative around enhancing engineering education was launched. Today, more than 30% of our faculty's professors are involved in this initiative, and it has become an important priority in the Faculty of Engineering. Our initiative involves a community of professors, graduate students, and educational developers committed to promoting excellence in the teaching and learning of 21st century technical and professional skills. Our objective is to provide professors and students with teaching skills and learning opportunities to develop the competency necessary to face tomorrow's complex engineering challenges. All this would not have been possible without the generosity and vision of our benefactor, the dedicated scholars within the faculty, and you, the community at large. Therefore, without further ado, I ask that you give a warm welcome to Professor Ken Bain, whose talk is entitled "When Learning Isn't Learning: Fostering Deeper Learning." Ken?
Thank you very much. I appreciate it enormously, and thank you for coming out this morning. I must warn you in advance that some of you could be disappointed with what we do this morning. You will be disappointed if you expect a simple list of do's and don'ts in good teaching. Because you see, fostering someone else's learning requires very deep thought and understanding on our part. So what I hope to do is to engage you in a deep conversation about some extraordinarily important issues in human learning. And I want to begin that conversation by asking you a question. I want you to think about something that you learned deeply because you took a deep approach to that learning. Now, I have a very specific definition in mind when I say learned deeply and took a deep approach to that learning. And that definition comes from a large and growing body of research and theoretical literature that began with a single experiment at a Swedish university in 1976. And on that particular occasion, the researchers did something that I suspect every teacher in the room has done. They gave a group of students a text, an article, and said, "Here, read this. When you finish, we're going to ask you some questions about it." So the students read the article, some more quickly than others, but the speed with which they read it did not matter nearly as much as did another factor that began to emerge once they began to ask them questions. And as they did, it quickly became apparent to the researchers that different students had taken, and that's the key word here, had taken fundamentally different approaches to that text. On one end of the scale, the students had simply tried to memorize as much of the article as possible. They looked for isolated pieces of information that they might commit to memory. They'd been told, "You're going to have some questions when you finish." They saw that as their goal. On the other end of the scale, the students had taken a very different approach. They had tried to find meaning lying behind the page and to think about the applications of that meaning and the implications of that meaning and the possibilities of that meaning. They looked for arguments in the article and distinguished in those arguments between evidence on the one hand and conclusions on the other. Theirs was a very different approach. Now, the researchers gave these two groups names. They called the first group surface learners and the second group deep learners. So that's in part what I mean when I ask you to think about something that you learned deeply because you took a deep approach to that learning. Now, here's my question. What motivated you to take that deep approach in the first place? Would you think about that for a minute and take out a piece of paper or a corner of your brain, whichever is handier, and to just jot down one or two of those major reasons, motivations for taking that deep approach to the learning. Did you do that? Have fun. What I'm going to do in about 30 seconds, not quite yet, but to ask you to turn to one other person sitting nearby you and compare your motivation with theirs. Just don't all turn in the same direction. But would you do that? And I'm going to wander around and listen in on some of these conversations. Well, I'm hearing some interesting ideas down front, but I wonder if we could open this up to a broader conversation. So, what were those motivations on your part? Let's start with this gentleman right here, if we could.
For me, I was solving a problem, and I just had to know. I didn't want to just leave it. I wanted to know.
Okay. Curiosity, fascination, intrigue, interest, so on and so forth. How many of you had something similar? Okay. All right. So what other motivations here? Different kinds of motivations? Or is that it? Yeah. One other?
So I think we all agreed that the three of us here had, it was a challenge of learning something. It was sort of a challenge that made us rise to an occasion, whether it was fear or needing to present something good to do good to students.
Okay. All right. Okay. So that curiosity, that fascination is extremely important. A need to know in some cases becomes important. As it turns out, there has actually been a fair amount of research around what leads people to take a deep approach in the first place. Now, much of that research has been done in Northern Europe, in the UK, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Hong Kong, and in a few other places around the world. But enough of it has been done in Canada and the United States to suggest that it applies to North American students as well. Now, if I were to summarize that research for you, it would go something like this. And I want you to think about this and see if this captures what you were saying to yourself. That most people are most likely to take a deep approach to their learning when they are trying to answer questions or solve problems that they, the learner, have come to regard as important, intriguing, fascinating, or in some cases, just beautiful. That capture what you were thinking? I think it probably does. We have a lot of evidence to suggest that that is when a deep approach to learning is likely to take place. Now, here's the problem. In a formal educational environment, the learner is usually not in charge of the questions. So we have a gap. We have a gap between those conditions, which your own experience and the research suggest are going to be most conducive to taking that deep approach to learning, and the conditions inherent in a formal educational environment. Now, I can make, and you can too, a very good case that it is rightfully so that you, the teacher, is in charge of the questions. You know more than your students. You can imagine questions that may not occur to them, but it nevertheless creates a gap. And how we fill that gap becomes extraordinarily important. I spent about 15 years of my life out looking for people who were extremely good at filling that gap. But we'll come back to that a little bit later on. In the meantime, I have a second question for you, and it's a little bit more complex than the first one. And this question is very simply, why is it that so many of our students will predominantly, not exclusively, but will predominantly take a surface or a third approach, which the literature began to identify by the 1980s, called a strategic approach to learning? Now, you laugh because you recognize the strategic student. But it means that we have three types. We have first the surface learner. And the research there suggests that the surface learner is driven largely by fear and a desire simply to survive. Have you ever had a student who would say, or you overheard them saying, if I can just get out of this course alive? That's the surface approach. And then secondly, We have, well, that strategic student, I should add, thinks that the easiest approach is memorizing stuff. Turns out to be one of the most difficult. How can you remember things that you do not even understand? But then we have the second approach, the strategic approach. And the research suggests here very simply that strategic students are driven largely by a desire for recognition, usually in the form of higher grades. They are the grade grubbers. They are the students who are driven almost exclusively by those grades. And because that is their motivation, they often achieve those grades. And we celebrate their efforts, don't we? We put them on the honors roll. We graduate them with honors. But we also know, I think, and the research confirms that knowing, that deep down inside, there are some limitations for students who take going after the grade as their primary preoccupation in learning. At least three major limitations. We know, for example, that students who are predominantly strategic in their approach will not be risk takers. They will not pursue their own curiosity for fear that going after something new might in fact jeopardize their grade point average. So they become very limited in what they learn. And secondly, we know that they tend to learn procedurally and not conceptually. They learn the procedures for doing a problem, for solving a problem, for writing a paper, for doing whatever is necessary. And they may know those procedures extremely well. But because they are procedural learners rather than conceptual learners, we also know from the research that they tend not to become what the literature calls adaptive experts. Now, they may become routine experts, but not adaptive ones. You know this distinction? It was first suggested by some Japanese theorist about 30 years ago. And the English words suggest what they mean by that. A routine expert is an expert who knows all the routines. You got this problem, this is what you do. You got this problem, this is what you do. And they know that. They know those connections. And in fact, they may even, in this conceptualization, they may even know those connections so well that they might even be considered world class in their expertise. They know so many of the common routines. But the adaptive expert also knows all those set routines. But they have something else. And that something else is both an ability and an attitude. It is the ability and the attitude both to recognize and to relish the opportunity and the necessity for invention. They are the people who like to take on those unknown problems, and they're good at it. Well, I submit to you that our world is changing so rapidly that we need adaptive experts. We are encountering new kinds of problems every day for which there is no set routine. Got a hole in the Gulf of Mexico. Remember that one from a few years ago? We need adaptive experts. We've got holes in our economy, unlike anything we've had before. We need adaptive experts. We've got holes in our social structure that are quite unusual. We need adaptive experts. We've got holes in our international fabric, unlike anything we've had before. We need adaptive experts. And so my question takes on special significance. Why is it that so many of our students will predominantly pursue a surface or strategic rather than a deep approach to learning. Because it is only those students who pursue that deep approach to learning who are likely to become those adaptive experts. Now, it would be presumptuous of me to attempt to try to summarize all of the extensive research on this question. But I'm going to attempt to do so. With a single word. You know the word? The word is conditioning. People are conditioned to take one of these three approaches. There's nothing natural about them. Well, maybe taking the deep approach actually is the more natural of the three. But they are conditioned to take a surface or strategic approach. Well, that then raises the question, where does that conditioning take place? And how does it take place? Well, it takes place everywhere. It takes place around the breakfast table. It takes place around the dinner table. It takes place at the movie theaters. It takes place in popular culture. It takes place everywhere. But there's one place in our culture and society in which much of that conditioning takes place. Guess where? You got it. She said, in school. In short, it's what we do. Well, not us, of course. It's all those other teachers, right? Who are conditioning people to take that deep, rather, to take that surface or strategic approach to learning. Now, here's my question for you. And in this room, this will be a little bit difficult, but I've done it in rooms like this before. So you can turn to people sitting next to you or behind you to form little groups of two or three or maybe even four. And I'd like for you to tackle this question. You may or may not be familiar with this research literature, but you're familiar with schooling. So I want you to draw on that familiarity and to just speculate. What is it about schooling that is most likely responsible for conditioning people to take that surface or strategic rather than a deep approach to their learning? Would you tackle that question? Again, have fun. What are you thinking? What are you thinking? I'm sorry?
One of the issues I was looking at was the formative structure for evaluation.
Yeah, I think you're onto something. Yeah. But why couldn't that also, just to play the devil's advocate, why couldn't that also foster a deep approach to learning? Okay. Yeah. I think you're on to something. Share that with them. Very good. What are you thinking up here?
Well, it's kind of talking about the teaching versus learning paradigm.
Yeah.
Right.
And then now we're talking about how
the
Okay, so grading plays a role. So how does it play that role? Okay. 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 I'm going to bring everybody back together and see if we can pursue that one a little bit more deeply. Very good. I think you're on to something. Well, I'm curious. As I walked up and down the stairs here just a few minutes, the most frequent word I heard was grading or assessment. How many of you mentioned that to yourself or to your colleagues? Wow, nearly everybody. But what is it about grading or assessment that might foster that surface or strategic approach to learning? Yeah, over here. We'll get a microphone to you. Hold on just a second.
It's what you mentioned. It's how we reward the students. If you have a good grade, you have the attention of everybody from the teacher to the dean. It's written on your diploma.
Okay.
If you don't have the grades.
But why couldn't that also foster a deep approach? I'm going to play the devil's advocate with you.
I think it's because our assessments are not evaluating deep learning. Our assessments are often evaluating surface learning.
So I think she's saying the form of the assessment can play a role. And certainly that is one of the research findings that, for example, if a student, just to pick a ridiculous example, extreme example, if a student is faced with a steady diet of, say, I don't know, multiple choice questions that merely require them to regurgitate isolated pieces of information, what are they going to begin to think? That learning is the ability to recognize correct answers on a multiple choice quiz. Reminds me of my favorite New Yorker cartoon from a few years ago. It's a scene in what appears to be a hospital room. You know, there's a guy in the bed, and there are two guys standing on one on each side, and they appear to be doctors, you know, have on those doctor-looking coats. And one of the doctors, the older one of the two, says to the younger one, "Well, what do you think's wrong?" And the younger one says, "I have no idea. I was expecting a multiple choice quiz." So we do condition students by the form of the examination. But there are some theorists, get this, who argue that the mere existence of grades has played a major role in fostering that surface and strategic approach to learning. What would lead some theorists to such a conclusion? Well, first of all, how many of you are familiar with the history of grades? How long have they been around? What do you have, numbers or letters?
Letters,
okay. So how long has that system of letters been around? Adam and Eve, right? No. It's actually the product of the Industrial Revolution. Late 18th century at the earliest, not widely adopted until the late 19th century. I'm not sure about Canada, but in the United States, the first major public school system to adopt the ABC system was the St. Louis public school system beginning in 1881, that late. But what is it about that system? And basically what it represented was it represented a point in time in which society began to impose upon educators a new set of responsibilities. The old set was educate the young. The new set is educate the young and, oh, by the way, also certify how much learning you think has taken place. So we invented grades as a kind of shorthand. Now, that pressure from society, at least in the United States, and I suspect in Canada as well, that pressure to certify how much learning has taken place has not diminished. It has increased. And over the course of the 20th century, we refined that system ever more, more and more precise, you know, with numbers to go all the way from 1 to 100, and with letters from A to A minus to B plus to B to B minus, so on and so forth. Trying to be even more precise in our shorthand to society, to students, to their parents. But what is it about that system that might lead these theorists to say, that's part of the problem? You got a thought up here, way up here. You're going to give him lots of exercise. He volunteered to do this, and I really appreciate it.
So, I mean, the whole reason for strategery is to play the game, the system, to get a grade.
Okay. But why would that lead to a deep approach? I mean, a surface approach.
Well, it leads to a strategic approach.
What?
It leads to a strategic approach.
Okay, why?
Because you're playing a game.
You're playing a game. But could playing a game actually lead to deep learning? We have some research that suggests that it sometimes does.
It could.
Yeah. So what is it about that game playing that might foster that surface or strategic approach? Yeah, over here in the corner.
There's a time constraint to the game. Time? There's a time limit. We have
a time
to,
limit?
Okay, we're
certainly
limiting
time,
how we can learn.
Time becomes a factor. If students do not have time in the United States, and I'm sure you haven't done this in Canada, heaven forbid, we reduced funding for higher education. You didn't do that, did you? And as a result, students, you know, it takes them a lot more money to acquire their higher education. They have to work like 35, 40 hours a week in order to be able to pay for their higher education. And then they have no time to learn. So time is, in fact, a factor here. We've got another thought down here. Yeah.
Well, I think the main reason to me is basically it's not something that comes from within. It creates something extrinsic. Motivation extrinsic. It's the grade. It's not the love of learning.
I think this is extraordinarily important. How many of you are familiar with some of the research on intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic? I think that's a key element in this conversation. One of the pioneers in that research was a man by the name of Edward Deci, not too far from here down at Rochester, University of Rochester. And a long time ago, Edward Deci came up with a thought problem that ran something like this. And I want you to think about his thought problem. He said, imagine that someone has a deep, personal, intrinsic interest in doing something. Now, his example was mowing a lawn. I actually cannot imagine that. But I don't know. Let's say that somebody has a deep intrinsic interest in learning. What are you learning?
Management.
I'm sorry?
Management.
And then someone else comes along in his thought problem and offers that person a reward or a punishment, an extrinsic motivation to keep on doing what they otherwise like to do. And then, in his thought problem, that extrinsic motivator is withdrawn. And his research question was, under that set of circumstances, what will happen to the level of the original intrinsic interest? Will it go up? Will it stay the same, or will it go down? You're saying down, but the prevailing social science of his day, this was the late 1960s when he came up with this thought problem, the prevailing social science predicted that it would actually go up. That social science was dominated by B.F. Skinner and behavioralism, and they had done all these experiments with rats running through mazes, and they gave the rat more cheese, and the rat suddenly appeared to be more motivated. or at least the rat could find the solution to the maze and surely was more motivated. But DC reasoned that maybe human beings are a little bit more complex than rats. So he came up with an experiment, a little bit more elaborate one, to test the proposition with human beings, not rats. And what he and others have discovered is exactly what you predicted, that it will go down in most circumstances, and it will go down, especially, as one of DC's colleagues put it, when the subject feels a loss of the locus of control. Now, I love the way you psychologists talk. I would put it a little bit differently. It goes down when people feel manipulated by that extrinsic motivator. Now, if you think about DC's thought problem and his research, I don't think you could come up with a better real-life example than schooling. Have you been around a 4 or 5-year-old lately? They will drive you crazy with their questions. I have 3 young grandsons, 12, 9, and 5, but especially the 5-year-old, just full of questions. Now, you take that same person a few years later after they've been to school, nothing. I remember some years ago, my niece, who's now, oh my goodness, she's 52 years old. But when she was a little girl, about 5 years old, she and I took an automobile trip from Austin, Texas to San Antonio, Texas. And in that 78 miles, that little girl asked me about 7,800 questions. And nearly every single one of them was about astronomy. Now, she didn't know the word astronomy from Adam. Adam's my oldest grandson. But she would ask me questions like, where's the sun at night? That's an astronomy question. Where are the stars during the day? That's another astronomy question. And she just kept asking me these astronomy questions all the way to San Antonio. And I'm trying to drive to circumnavigate the trucks that are in my way. And she's hitting me with these astronomy questions. I finally start getting very sarcastic with her and saying things like, well, there's no such thing as a sunset. Well, there isn't. It's an earth roll, right? So no matter how sarcastic I got with her, she would come back with another question. Well, to make a long story a little bit shorter, I finally got her to San Antonio, much exhausted from the experience, turned her over to her parents. And I didn't see her a whole lot for the upcoming years, but I remember seeing her when she was, I guess, probably a junior in college at Clemson University. It was at a family reunion, and I went up to her, and I said, Andra, what are you going to take next semester? You got the junior spring semester of your junior year coming up. And she looked at me in complete disgust. You know, why are you asking me about school at this festive occasion? And finally she muttered a bunch of required stuff. And I said, oh, like what? And she said, ah, you know where this is going. I have to take a science class. I said, what'd you decide to take? And she said, ah, signed up for an astronomy class. I said, oh, I know you're very interested in astronomy, remembering the 5-year-old. And she looked at me like I was completely crazy. Something tragic had happened to her in the meantime. She had gone to school. And in the process of which, she had lost all of that childhood curiosity. Now, there's a happy ending to this story. And Andra, I want you to note, in case you see this videotape, that I added this happy ending. A few years ago, she and her young sons came through New Jersey, where we live, on their way up to Boston, and they spent the night with us. And over dinner that night, I sort of mentioned to her that I'd been going around the world telling stories about her. And she looked at me and she said, "Do you know what I do for a living today?" And I said, "No, I have no idea. I haven't seen you in years." And all 5'2" of her stood up very proudly and said, "I teach astronomy." So something happened to her in that class. And there's a lesson in there for all of us, because when we look out on a class of students, no matter how old they are, there's a 5-year-old inside each one of them. And we have to find that 5-year-old. And sometimes we have to find that 5-year-old in ourselves, and to revive that natural curiosity that exists. But this is an important question. What is it that drives curiosity and fascination? And what are those motivations that will lead to deep learning? But there's a third major question that I want to raise in your mind. And I do warn you this time, this is the most complex of the three. It is this: what do we do about our brains? And that's the piece I want to get you to think about. I want you to think about your own brain for a moment, and how it works, and how your learning works, and how your learning began. And I'd like to carry you back to the very beginning of your learning, when you were lying there in the crib, about 2 minutes old. I want you to think about what was happening to you in those first few minutes and hours and days of life. Well, you were being bombarded by sensory input from the moment you were born. And really, they tell us now, even before that. But you were being bombarded by sensory input. You have 5 senses at most: here and here and here and here and here. And you received all that sensory input. What'd you do with it? Well, you tried to make sense of it, didn't you? Now, how'd you do that? You didn't have a dictionary in your diaper you could whip out and look it up. So how did you make sense of that sensory input? Well, you did so by doing something that human brains do extraordinarily well. That is, you began to notice patterns. And as you notice patterns, you began to build in your own mind little models of how the world works, little schematas of how the world works, little paradigms of how the world works. And at first, those models were pretty simple. When you're 2 days old, your model was, "I cry, I get fed." That's my model of the world. But as time goes on, those models become more and more complex. And you began to combine models, and you began to combine models of sound. And you put meaning to those sounds, and we develop models of language, don't we? But something else began to happen almost at the very beginning of this process. And that something else is extremely important for our considerations here this morning. You not only built those models of reality, you began to use them to understand new sensory input. And you have been doing that for your entire life. And that has huge implications for your learning. So, for example, how many of you besides Marcia and I had never been in this auditorium prior to this morning? Okay? So you'd never been here. You'd never been here. So what, you walked through that door? You walk through that door. It doesn't matter. All right? And as you walk through that door, you got some sensory input, right? An electromagnetic field we call light tickled the retina of your eye, and you had a sensation we call seeing. Now, how did you understand this room? Now, you think about this, folks. This is amazing. This woman had never been here before in her entire life. She walks in, gets a little sensory input, and immediately understands this room. Now, how did you do that? Did you do it just in terms of that electromagnetic field we call light tickling the retina of your eye? I don't think so. I think you did it because you already had a model of something called an auditorium with progressively rising seats. You had a model of something we call an aisle and of rows and of pull-down seats. And you understood this room, not just in terms of that electromagnetic field. You understood this room in terms of models that you had built long ago and far away. And we all did that, right? The first time we appeared in this place. Now, that model has enormous influence. And maybe even more influence than the electromagnetic field that's tickling the retina of your eye. Now, we do that on a regular basis. And that ability, that habit of understanding a completely new situation in terms of a pre-existing model proves to be enormously useful. Can you imagine what life would be like if we didn't have that capacity? I understand, I've never seen this movie, but I understand a few years ago there was a really stupid movie based on the premise that someone didn't have this ability, something like 50 First Dates or some such thing. Do you ever see that movie? Yeah. Don't admit it in public. Just kidding. So we do have that capacity, and it proves to be enormously useful, doesn't it? But that ability and that habit also proves to be one of our greatest challenges as learners and as educators. Now, why? Because often, especially in deep learning, we want our students to build new models of reality. Or at minimum, to understand the problems they face in believing whatever they may believe. And the problems they face in continuing to entertain their existing models. I come from the humanities. I'm a historian. And we say in the humanities that the mark of an educated person is a person who realizes the problems they face in believing whatever they may believe. My friends in the sciences and in engineering will go a little bit further and they'll say, no, I actually want my students to abandon this model and move to this one. Whether it be that the earth is the center of the universe or whatever the model may be. In the humanities, we'd never say that. We'd just say, okay, we want them to understand the problems that they would face in continuing to entertain the idea that the earth is the center of the universe. But either way, your way or my way, we are both asking students to do something that might even be considered an unnatural act. Now, the problem to which I refer here is, I think, well illustrated by a story that I tell at the beginning of the second chapter of this book, What the Best College Teachers Do. Have any of you read that book, by the way? Okay, a few people have, all right. By the way, any of you who raised your hand, do you suffer from insomnia? That's not the reason. Okay, all right. Thank you, I appreciate that. But either way, We've got a problem. Now, that story is a very simple one. It's about, you may know this story, even independent of the book. But it goes something like this. There were these two physicists at Arizona State University who some years ago asked this question. Does my introductory course in physics change the way students think about and understand motion? Now, if you're not in physics, you can substitute anything that fits. Does my course change the way students think about and understand? Well, you fill in the blank. Well, in the case of physics, presumably, that introductory course would change the way someone would understand motion. If it doesn't, then you've got one of two conditions. Either one, they don't need to take the course because they're already there in their understanding. Or two, the course failed them, or they failed the course. So it's an important question. So to find out the answer, these two physicists devised an instrument, still widely used in physics, called the Force Concept Inventory. And they gave that instrument to about 600 students coming in to an introductory course in physics. Now, what they discovered on the front end was that the overwhelming majority of those students conceived of motion pretty much in Aristotelian terms. Now, without going into details on what that means, let's just say you couldn't put a satellite in orbit with that concept of motion, nor could you build a highway around a curve. But that's before they took the course. It's not a nonsensical view. In fact, it's a view that for 3,000 years, intelligent human beings held this view. Not until the time of Newton did they begin to change it. But since Newton, our whole concept of motion has changed dramatically, let alone the contributions of Feynman in the 20th century. But this is before the students took the course. They had that Aristotelian view. The students then took the course, and some made A's, some made B's, C's, so on and so forth. And then, some weeks after the course was over, they brought the students back, and they gave them exactly the same instrument all over again to see how much change had taken place. Guess what? For the overwhelming majority of those students, the change was virtually none. But it gets worse. So I'm glad you're sitting down. They also discovered that the degree of change was not predictable by the grades that the students made. So that the A students and the C students were just as likely or just as unlikely to have changed their basic concept of motion. Now, how can that be? How can someone make an A in a modern physics course and continue to conceive of motion in Aristotelian rather than Newtonian terms? It can be because of the way the human brain works. They took their model, their Aristotelian model of motion with them to class. And they took all of the sensory input they received. The lectures they heard, the textbooks they read, that's just all sensory input. The lab work they did, they took all that sensory input and they simply wrapped it around their already existing model. And that model never changed. But it doesn't just happen to physics students. It happens to all of our students. Because last time I checked, we're all teaching human beings. It happens to my students in history. And in fact, one of the best books on how to learn how to think like a good historian, how to think historically,
The title of the book summarizes the point I'm trying to make. The title of the book, by the way, is Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts. Because in these terms, historical thinking is an unnatural act. To think historically, you have to put yourself in that historical moment and be able to look at it from the perspective of evidence derived from that moment. And what do students want to do instead? They want to look at it from the perspective of the models they have built about their lives in the early 21st century. And to get them to let go and put themselves in 5th century B.C. is extremely difficult, let alone 19th century Canada. So they hold on to their models. All of our students do. And it's extremely difficult to get them to let go. So does that mean that deep learning is impossible? No, I don't think so. When I started this conversation with you, I asked all of you to think about a moment when you learned deeply. And I don't think anybody raised their hand, did they? And say, I never learned deeply. So we do learn deeply. But what are the circumstances under which that deep learning is most likely to take place? And on top of all of that, how do we address what is called the transfer problem in learning? We discovered the transfer problem several years ago in working with medical students. And what we discovered is that medical students could, for example, learn a great deal of information about how the heart works, how the lungs work, how the circulatory system works, how muscles work, how everything in the body works, and they could spew out that information on examinations of great detail. But when presented with a simulated patient and asked to do a differential diagnosis, that is, to transfer their knowledge from one domain to another, from the classroom to the clinic, they couldn't do it. And their differential diagnoses were almost at random. And even on the simplest of cases, couldn't do it. So we began to analyze this problem from a learning perspective and to realize that learning isn't always learning. But how do we overcome that problem? That was really the whole point of the research I did, out looking for people who were phenomenally successful in fostering both a deep approach to learning and a deep achievement in learning. Because you see, the deep approach is a necessary condition. You have to intend to learn deeply in order to do so. And that becomes the first obstacle. But even if you do have that deep intention, it doesn't mean that you will actually be able to grasp those concepts deeply because of your brain and the inability to let go of the models that you hold. So how do you get students to let go of their models? In essence, what I did is I began studying people who had that great success in fostering that kind of learning. I interviewed them. I sat in on their classes. I took their classes. I videotaped them. I interviewed their students. I collected materials that they had on paper. And from all of that, I began to draw some conclusions. I looked at people from open admission schools and from highly selective institutions. I looked at people in engineering, in the sciences, in the humanities, in the arts, in the performing arts, in business, and in a wide variety of different areas. And I wanted to know, one, is there some consistent answer that appears in all of these situations? And if not, what are the differences? Well, here's what I found. Most important, these people created a special kind of learning environment. And I saw this environment regardless of the nature of the class, the discipline, the nature of the students, the school, or whatever else. I saw the same kinds of environments consistently, so consistently I gave it a name. I called it a natural critical learning environment. And thus far, we have teased out about 15 different elements of that natural critical learning environment. I'd like for us to play with just two or three of them. And the first of those is this, that you must put the learner in a situation in which their existing model will not work. Simply telling them that it won't work won't change their model. They'll go right back to their model. But putting them in a situation where their existing model does not work begins to turn the trick. But it only begins to turn the trick. Because the second condition is they must care that it doesn't work. And they must care deeply enough to be willing to stop and grapple. And as they grapple, to build new models of reality. Now, here's my question to you. I want you to think about a course that you teach. And first to think about and ask yourself, what are some of the major mental models that my students are likely to bring to my course that I will want them at minimum to question and perhaps to abandon? And how will I create what we call an expectation failure? That's putting them in a situation where their model doesn't work. How will I create an expectation failure for them about which they will care? I'd like for you this very morning at this time to begin to struggle with that issue. How long do you need? About 7 years, she says. And that's probably true. But we don't have 7 years, at least not according to my schedule. So let's take about 5 minutes. And you can talk to yourself. You can talk to your neighbor. But I want you to struggle with these questions. One, what mental models are they likely to bring that I will want them to begin to challenge? You may never have thought about your course this way, but I guarantee you that if you do, it will be enormously revealing to you. And then secondly, how will I create an expectation failure for them about which they will care? In other words, how do you get them to care? Okay? Have fun. And again, I'm going to circulate around and listen in on some of these conversations and maybe make it all the way up to the top. So what are some of those major mental models that students are likely to bring to your course? Anybody want to share with them? I've had this discussion with about 100,000 faculty members around the world in the last 20 years or so. And I've noticed that there are three types of models that people mention. One is a model that the students will have about themselves. Anybody got one of those? A model that students have about themselves? You got one up, way up here? All right. Of course, it would be on the top row.
They're bad at math.
Ah, yes, I'm just not a math person. Yeah, it's a model they have about themselves. Yeah. How many of you know Carol Dweck's work? Extraordinarily important and valuable. She deals with something called mindsets. And that's one of the mindsets, you know. That would be a fixed mindset, this notion that my brain is fixed. You're either a good math person or you're not. I'm not. That's it. Case closed. A flexible mindset is the notion that, well, I haven't learned it yet, but I can. And what Carol has found, not surprisingly, is that people who have a fixed mindset often develop a sense of helplessness. And that's easy to imagine if somebody pegs themselves down here, I'm bad at math. Well, obviously, they're going to be bad at math. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But Carol and her colleagues have discovered that people who have a fixed mindset and actually peg themselves up here can also develop a sense of helplessness. Perhaps best illustrated by a story that appeared in the New Yorker some years ago and has been written up in the research literature. It's a young lad who was 11 years old at the time. He was in a very special school in Manhattan. I think it's PS 57. And in that school, to get in there when you're in the 6 years old, you have to take an IQ test. Can you imagine? And you have to score in the upper 1%. Well, he not only scored in the upper 1%, he made the highest score anyone had ever made on their IQ test. And he had been told repeatedly the rest of his life, you are a genius. And he had developed a very fixed mindset that intelligence is fixed. It's not malleable. You can't stretch it. And he had built his whole self-image around that notion, I'm a genius. But by age 11, his teachers and his parents described him as a young man who was totally uninterested in anything. He wouldn't try new things. He wouldn't try new subjects. And why? Because he had a fixed mindset. And you see, he had built his whole self-image around that notion, I'm a genius, and he was afraid to fail. And if he tried something new, he might experience failure that would undermine his whole concept. And we often find people who have that fixed mindset being afraid of failure. I did this subsequent book, What the Best College Students Do, which I looked at 36 people who went to college and who became very productive and very creative individuals. Several Nobel laureates, for example. And when I interviewed these people and studied their lives and their work and their motivation, I discovered that they all embraced failure. Dudley Hirschbach, a Nobel laureate in chemistry, told me that I won the Nobel Prize because I'm a big failure. I fail so many times in my research, but it was those failures that led me to real insights. And we found that again and again and again with scientists and engineers and other people who had that flexible mindset. Of course, this raises the question, where do those fixed and flexible mindsets come from? And the short answer, which we won't have time to explore but made this afternoon in the workshop, is that they come from us. We give them to them. But how we give them to them is more subtle than you might imagine. I recommend her work. Well, the second kind of mindset that I've encountered is mindsets that students have about the nature of learning and about the nature of education. Anybody got one of those? You got one? Yeah. What is that?
Oh, sorry. They believe that I'm responsible for their learning, that the teacher,
if they succeed,
it's because of me, or if they fail, it's because of me.
Yeah, exactly. They think of you as a giant yellow highlighter. And they think of learning as memorizing stuff. So you, the giant yellow highlighter, are responsible for going through and showing them which things that they need to remember for the examination. But it all stems from their conception of what it means to learn. So that's an important mental model. to say the least. And then finally, and there's no way of classifying this third category, it's models that students have within the discipline. And here, the models we'll come up with are going to be depend upon the discipline. But who's got a model within the discipline? Did you have one earlier? I couldn't remember. Somebody. Give us a model within the discipline that students may have. Yeah, way up here. Shout it out because I'm not going to climb up there.
Difference.
I'm sorry, can you do that again with a microphone because I can understand what you said.
Example from electrical engineering. So power can flow in an AC network without a voltage difference.
Okay. So you think of your own models in your own discipline that students are likely to bring. And if you say to me, well, they don't know anything about my subject because they have no models, that's simply not true. They are not blank slates. Human beings are not blank slates from the moment they are born. And they have literally millions of models, and they will use some of those models to understand what it is you want them to understand, if they try at all. And those models become extraordinarily important. Now, how do you create an expectation failure for them about which they will care? That's the really tricky part, isn't it? How do you get them to care? Any insights there? Yeah, over here. You got it? Oh, wow, really giving you a workout here. Thank you very much.
Immediately when you proposed that first question, I thought grades. But then again, it's the extrinsic.
Yeah, that's the problem. If you use the extrinsic, you will actually reduce their interest, which reduces the likelihood that they will take a deep approach.
That we spoke and we were kind of saying we could get them to grade each other's papers because peers care.
Yeah, but let's think about this in terms of where we started this conversation. You remember? We started by concluding, and I think all of you agreed to this conclusion, I'm not sure, that human beings are most likely to take a deep approach when they are trying to answer questions or solve problems that they, the learner, have come to regard as important, intriguing, beautiful. Here's what I discovered among these teachers that I studied. That they often organize their entire class around those kinds of questions. They organize their classes around questions that the students would regard as important, intriguing, or beautiful. Now, the problem that so many of us face, I face, you face, you're an advanced learner. And that creates a problem in cultivating the learning of a beginning learner. Because you are currently interested. It has advantages too. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. It has advantages, but it has some challenges. As an advanced learner, you are currently interested in certain questions because you were once interested in another question. And you were interested in that question because you were once interested in another question. Because you were once interested in another question. And so on and so forth up the line. And so while you are deep underground digging at what you know to be extraordinarily valuable intellectual ore, your students are standing on the surface wondering why anybody in their right mind would be so far underground. And what we saw these outstanding teachers doing is that ability to retrace their own journey and to go back to the top and to take students by the hand and create those inherently intriguing kinds of problems that would lead students to progressively more and more complex problems. So, a wide variety of ways of doing that, but I'm wondering if it would be useful if I gave you a couple of examples. Would that be helpful? Let's begin with one in math. Okay? Subject in hand is a professor by the name of Donald Sari, S-A-A-R-I. He's a professor of math now at the University of California. Before that, he was at Northwestern University outside of Chicago. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, very distinguished mathematician. He's also one of the best calculus teachers you'll ever encounter. And what Donald does is he goes into class the first day, and he has two items. One is a roll of toilet paper. Secondly, is a big paper cutout. And he first holds up the big paper cutout. And with a great sense of fun, and that's a key item here, and a great sense of humor, and that also is a key item here. Now, Don happens to have a very natural and a little bizarre sense of humor. His name is Sari, S-A-A-R-I, so he loves to come up to people, stick out his hand, and say, "I'm sorry." You saw this coming, didn't you? So he's that kind of guy. But that sense of humor plays an important role because it creates a non-threatening atmosphere where students can get this, try, they can fail, they can receive feedback right on the spot, they can try again, they can fail again, they can receive feedback right on the spot without anyone coming up to them and saying, "You're making a B minus thus far." In short, what he's trying to do is to create the kind of learning environment that every professor expects for themselves. Don't you? You're working on a project. You have an idea, a research design. You take that idea down the hall to a colleague and ask for some feedback from that colleague. You would be terribly insulted if that colleague looked you in the face and said, "You're making a C+ thus far." You would expect some substantive feedback so you could take it back to your office, to your laboratory, to the library, and rework it. That's the kind of environment that we expect as professionals in the field, but it is often not the kind of environment that we give to students. We instead instruct, meaning we give them information, then we test, meaning we ask them to recall that information or solve problems with it. Then we record the results, and those results count toward that final summative assessment of them. We don't give them that opportunity of trying, failing, receiving feedback. But a few years ago, when Derek Bok was president at Harvard University, he wanted to know what are the qualities of the courses at this institution that students will find most intellectually and professionally rewarding. So he commissioned Dick Light over in the Kennedy School to do a study along those lines. So Dick began interviewing students and former students. And when he published his conclusions, he had two major conclusions. One was that there were courses that set very high but very meaningful standards. Standards that were important not just within the class, get your paper in on time, but were important outside of the class. And secondly, as Dick put it, they were courses in which students had plenty of opportunity to try, to fail, to receive feedback, and try again. So that's what Donald Sari is doing, you see. So he begins to play with them. He holds up this paper cutout. He looks at it with that great sense of fun, turns to them and says, "This is the area under the curve. Now, how can we calculate what that area is?" Notice what he's doing. It's the first day of class. And what is he asking them to do? Calculus before they even know calculus. And that's another feature of the critical learning, natural critical learning environment, getting students to do the discipline before they even know the discipline. So he's trying to get them to invent calculus. And he begins to play with them. And he first, because there is no response, he'll take out a pair of scissors, cut off a strip, and he says, this is part of the area. If we just had that much, how could we calculate that? And again, there may be no answers. So he points out, well, it's almost a rectangle, isn't it? If it were a rectangle, how would you calculate the area? Finally, somebody in the back of the room will say, height times width. Okay, let's take that much. But what are you going to do with that curved area? And he continues to play with them that way, getting them to invent calculus. And he told me that his secret desire was that by the end of the course, they would feel a little frustrated that they had not been born prior to Newton. Otherwise, they would have invented it. But getting them to invent the calculus and occasionally to step in, as he puts it, and add the muscle of 300 years or so of calculus thought. But primarily getting them to construct, to solve the problem and having fun doing so and creating it as a game. Now we're beginning to discover that turning the problems into a game can become a big boost. It's an example of what we call a goal-based scenario. That is, creating a goal that may be bigger and even extraneous to the class itself, like the goal of winning the game. But in the course of playing the game, they learn. And they sometimes learn very deeply. My young grandsons are now playing a game. They're 5, 9, and 12, and the 9 and the 12-year-old have played this game endlessly on their iPhones or their iPads. It's a game called Dragon Box, invented by a mathematician in France. And the object of the game is, well, you have a dragon who's very shy and who lives in a box and doesn't like to be around other things. So your object is to isolate the dragon. And as you go through the game, you gain new powers for isolating the dragon. And about level high, and who lives, oh, I don't know, 6 or 7, the dragon, and doesn't like to be, or turns into an X. And you're isolating X. And what we have discovered in a giant research project at the University of Washington in Seattle is that students playing this game for X number of hours can actually learn the concepts of algebra much more deeply than can the typical high school student taking a 30-week course in algebra. So it's creating a goal-based scenario, creating a question, beginning with a question that the students would find fascinating. And of course, that leads to the question, what about the toilet paper? So what does he do with the toilet paper, you would imagine? What's a question that a mathematician would ask about a roll of toilet paper? Is there enough? No, that's not it. The volume, of course. But I asked him, I said, Don, why did you choose a roll of toilet paper? You could have chosen a bottle or a can or something like that. And he said, you know, because it's crazy. And the students will find it crazy. And it will help me to create that non-threatening atmosphere. I don't ask big questions like other professors do. I ask those crazy questions where students can do it. And it does have some mathematical tie-in, of course, because there is a relationship, after all, between the area of a square of the toilet paper and the total volume of the roll. But it's that crazy pedagogical reason that really drove him to choose the toilet paper and to create those problems in that non-threatening atmosphere. And we've watched people do similar kinds of things in a wide variety of other disciplines. One of my favorites is far afield from engineering or anything that probably anybody else represents in this room, but I'll share this with you nevertheless. A guy by the name of Andy Kaufman, not that Andy Kaufman, no, but he's a professor of Russian literature at the University of Virginia. And how could you take these principles and apply it to Tolstoy's short stories? Well, what he did is he went to a juvenile detention facility, otherwise known as a jail, for young people, young males. And he arranged with the warden of that jail for his students to go into that jail and to conduct discussions, small group discussions, with the inmates around some of the great questions that Tolstoy raised in his literature, particularly in the short story, The Death of Ivan Illich. Stories, questions about what's the meaning of life? What's my purpose in life? Where am I going? These became extraordinarily important to those inmates. And they became important now to the UVA students. And we're discovering that when there is some altruistic connection, you know, that they're doing some good for a broader society, the learning becomes that much deeper. So he created this goal-based scenario around which they could learn and learn very deeply. When I interviewed those students, they said, I'm no longer writing papers for my professor. I'm changing the lives of other people who are not much younger than I am. And then my final example, very far afield from what you teach, but because you're adaptive experts, you can adapt it to the fields of engineering. And indeed, you can. The young woman who teaches political history in the United States. And in 2006, when she was preparing to teach a course, she had a question on her mind. But her question was a question of an advanced learner. Now, her question was, what kind, I think this will work with the Canadian audience. Her question was, what kind of influence did that period we call Reconstruction, it's a 12-year period following the American Civil War, 1865 to 1877, Reconstruction. What kind of influence did that period have on subsequent political developments and institutions in this country? That was her question. Now, I can see that you all are extremely excited about this question. And in all honesty, can you imagine, even in the United States, going into class and finding, oh, let's say, anybody who would just be dying to pursue this question? Well, probably not. So she didn't ask that question. Instead, she asked a question that she knew was already on the minds of her students. And she knew it was on the minds of her students that fall, because she knew that in the fall of 2006, it was on the minds of most people in the United States. And she knew that because she's also a pollster. And in fact, she has data that suggested that this became the single most influential question that shaped the outcome of the national elections in the United States in both 2006 and in 2008. Now, I'm going to ask you the impossible question. Can you imagine what that question was? Sometimes Canadians and Chinese and other people get the answer, and people from the United States don't. They've forgotten. But anybody imagine? Let me give you a little hint. It began to appear in our minds on a rainy night of August 28th, 2005. that trigger a hint? No, still nothing. It began to appear in our minds. You got it? No? Hmm? Katrina, is that what you said? You're exactly right. The question was, what in the world happened with that disaster? Katrina wasn't the biggest hurricane to ever stalk the Gulf waters. That was Allen in 1980, and Marcia and I lived through Allen. And Allen uprooted trees and overturned cows and invented cow tipping. But other than that, it did not destroy an American city. But here came Katrina, a smaller hurricane, and it destroys the city of New Orleans. We were asking ourselves, how did that disaster happen? And behind that question was another question that no one really ever spoke out loud, but we all thought it. Namely, if that ever happens to my community, you know, if a hurricane comes up the St. Lawrence, for example, unlikely, and destroys my community, will there be anybody there to help me? And that was the question we were all asking. So Melissa organized a course she entitled Disaster, Katrina, and American Politics, and invited her students to study not Reconstruction history, but to study disasters. The class filled within about 5 minutes of registration. Turned out at least that year at that school, young people wanted to study disasters and were fascinated with them. I'm not quite sure why, but they were. And the class filled. She cut it off at 80 students. The students came into class and she began the discussion. The first question she asked in the discussion was, when did the disaster begin? Did it begin on the night of August 28, 2005, when the storm surge hit New Orleans? Or did it begin in 1866 with the coming of Reconstruction to the Crescent City? And with that question alone, she transformed their interest into her interest. And for her and for her students, it was a transformative moment. I interviewed those students and they said things like, that course changed my life. And at the end of the course, they did something that Melissa never anticipated. They came to her and they said, Professor, we all need to go to New Orleans to study the situation on the ground and better understand it. And she says to this day that their deepest learning took place once they arrived in New Orleans. Now, why? Because they'd encountered an expectation failure. You see, they had a mental model. They brought it to New Orleans, and the situation on the ground confronted their mental model. I'm exaggerating here only slightly, but their mental model was pretty much along these lines. Slight exaggeration here, but it was basically, I'm a bright undergraduate college student. This was at Princeton, at a leading American university. Once I arrive in New Orleans and walk down the street, the problems will disappear in the wake of my coming. Now, I'm exaggerating only slightly, but that was pretty much their model. And she says that the situation on the ground was so complex, it began to challenge their model, and their deep learning began to take place. She created an expectation failure. A few years ago, I brought Melissa to my campus and had her explain about her course, and I had a chemistry professor come up to me and say, you know, I could create a chemistry class around that same subject, and maybe even you could create a chemical engineering class around that subject. After all, there are a lot of petrochemical plants along the Gulf Coast. But whatever it is, to create that goal-based scenario and to ask big questions and to ask questions that are, in fact, bigger than the class itself, and to create that situation where students have that opportunity to try, to fail, to receive feedback, and to try again, and to get that kind of feedback that will foster that growth mindset on their part, that they can, in fact, increase their abilities. They may not know it yet, but they have the capacity to do so with the right kind of work. But it does all center on asking the right kind of question. All those other ingredients and all 10 or 12 others that I haven't even mentioned here, available in handouts that I'll give out this afternoon, or maybe can be available more generally to folks even this morning, will list for you. Creating that goal-based scenario where students take on those big problems that they regard as important, intriguing, and fascinating. Let me close with one quick story, and the point of this story is that little things you do can have a huge influence. It's a story about a social psychologist by the name of Margaret Shee. She's now at UCLA. She was at Harvard when this story took place. As a social psychologist, she was aware of some earlier research pioneered by Claude Steele and Joshua Aronson that had found, get this, that if you are a member of a group within your society about which there is a pervasive negative social stereotype, that the mere existence of that stereotype within your culture can and usually does adversely affect your performance, even if you personally reject the stereotype. Now, if you accept the stereotype, obviously it's going to affect you. My people can't do math, so it will affect you. But even if you don't accept it, so the research finds, it can subtly affect you because on a subconscious level, it simply bothers you that other people may be thinking of you in terms of that stereotype. So Margaret knew that research. But she asks some fresh, new questions. She said, we have lots of negative stereotypes in our culture. I'm sure you have none of these in Canada. We, for example, have a negative stereotype that women are not as good at higher mathematics as are men. You don't have that in Canada, right? Thank goodness. But that actually exists south of the border. And she said, okay, that's a negative stereotype. But we have another stereotype that is quite positive. We have the stereotype that Asians and Asian Americans are naturally good at math. Now, I don't know where that one came from. I just woke up one day when I was about 25 years old, and there it was in our culture. And my daughter-in-law, who is Asian American, says it's just true. So, she's kidding. Margaret's question was, what if we took Asian American women? So that's what she did. She created three comparable groups of Asian American women. They were all in mathematically oriented disciplines. They were all wanted to go to graduate school. They had all done equally well. They had similar SAT scores. They had similar grade point averages. And she gave each one of these young women in each of these three groups the advanced portion of the GRE in mathematics. And she had very reliable predictors that their group performances would be indistinguishable. Those were the predictors. But that's not what happened. It's not what happened because of what Margaret did. It was her experiment. What she did is she asked each of these young women in each of these three groups to fill out a questionnaire before they took the test. It looked very innocent. Name, address, telephone number, that sort of thing. About 9 or 10 items. But the first group had a single question that was intended to subtly remind them of their gender. I'll tell you how subtle it was. It asked them, do you live in co-ed housing? And previous research had found that a mere mention of co-ed housing, where men and women live together, would trigger a subconscious reminder of gender. The second group didn't have that question. They instead had a single question that was intended to subtly remind them of their ethnicity. They all checked the same box because they were all Asian Americans. And the third group had neither of those two questions. You now know, or have the data to know, how each of the three groups did. The group that it was reminded of its ethnicity did significantly better than did the other two groups. The group that was reminded of its gender performed the worst of the three. And the group that had neither reminder was right in the middle. Little things you do can have a huge influence on the lives and the academic successes and failures of your students. Good luck in figuring out what all those little things are. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it immensely, and I hope this has been meaningful to you. Thank you. I should be applauding you, not me. It's you. Thank you very much. You're very kind. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ken. So on behalf of the Faculty of Engineering and McGill University as a whole, I'd just like to thank you for a very enjoyable conversation.
Thank you.
As you so put it, I hope everybody here can take some of what we've discussed today and bring it back with them to help them in their own paths.
Thank you.
I'd also, on behalf of the faculty, also like to thank McGill Teaching and Learning Services for helping us organize this event, and in particular, Justin Fletcher. Lastly, please return your exit surveys on the way out. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.